Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, one of the most fundamental features of the Trump administration is a policy of limiting immigration and reversing U.S. policy on work visas, asylum, and deportation policy. What is the status of this policy in light of recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions and the COVID-19 pandemic? Contributing host Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. This term, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration's attempt to repeal the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, was unconstitutional. The Dreamers, as DACA recipients are nicknamed, were originally protected from deportation by an executive action during the Obama administration. We will discuss this case, as well as several other cases dealing with U.S. immigration policy, with Peter Spiro, Charles R. Wiener Professor of Law at Temple University. He is author of Citizenship, What Everyone Needs to Know. And Hiroshi Motomura, Susan Westerberg Prager Distinguished Professor of Law at UCLA. He is author of Immigration Outside the Law. Peter Spiro, what is DACA and what exactly was decided in this Supreme Court case?
So DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And it was a program adopted by the Obama administration, in effect giving a kind of protective status to a community of several hundred thousand individuals who entered the United States before they were 16 years of age and who satisfied certain other requirements. They're basically what in the popular parlance are known as the Dreamers. Non-citizens who entered the United States illegally at a young age and who grew up in the United States and are still present in the United States. So those are the so-called DACA beneficiaries. President Trump attempted to rescind the program, and that rescission is what was at issue in the case as it presented to the Supreme Court.
And Hiroshi Motomura, this seems to be fairly consistent with Trump administration policy on immigration since his election in 2016. What exactly legally do you see the Trump administration trying to accomplish broadly with immigration policies?
Well, there are a couple of ways to think about the Trump administration's attitudes on immigration. Some of it has to do with its response to unlawful immigration. Some of it has to do with its response to legal immigration. So the Trump administration has taken a very hard line on things like the border wall, also on interior enforcement. There are a number of things we could talk about that are in that general category. The Trump administration has been particularly skeptical of asylum claims, refugees. And then it's also become clear that the Trump administration is skeptical or hostile to the levels of legal immigration that we've had. And that's manifested itself in responses to some non-immigrant visas, in other words, temporary workers, for example, also some of the legal immigration categories. And then it shouldn't be forgotten that the Trump administration has issued some executive orders and proclamations that target some majority Muslim countries, a number of other countries, especially in Africa. So that's a lot to cover. So in a sense, the rescission of DACA or the attempted rescission of DACA fits into a larger immigration agenda.
So Peter Spiro, DACA was an executive action. I remember when it was announced, it was particularly, Republicans were particularly critical of this as an extension of executive power. The Trump administration's argument was that they can rescind it because since it's an executive order, they should be allowed to rescind it. Why weren't they allowed to do that?
Well, it actually wasn't an executive order. It was a so-called executive action. Okay. So it was implemented through a memorandum by the then Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano. And in the ordinary course, you're absolutely right that an executive action by one administration can be reversed by a subsequent administration. What the Supreme Court did in invalidating the rescission is to call the Trump administration on its process. That if you're going to undertake this kind of reversal, you have to jump through certain hoops, you have to consider certain factors, you have to act in a way that, to use the jurisprudential vocabulary, is not arbitrary and capricious. And what John Roberts found in his opinion in this case is that, in fact, the administration's action was arbitrary and capricious. This was an administrative law decision, not an immigration law decision. As in some other cases, for instance, the census case involving the citizenship question, the Supreme Court is, in effect, calling the administration for just not doing its homework. But this was not a decision on the merits of the DACA program. In effect, what the Supreme Court is saying is handing it back to the administration and saying, you can do this, you just have to do it right. You just have to do it the right way. And that's what the Trump administration apparently is now going to pursue, is undertaking the rescission, but making sure that it's crossing all its T's and dotting all its I's here.
So, Hiroshi, do you think that it's likely that this program would be repealed if Trump is reelected in 2020?
If we're talking about a second Trump term, I think that it's quite likely that they'll go through with the rescission. You know, it's hard to say, but I think that what's stopping the Trump administration from going through the rescission immediately may be the election, right? Because of the popularity of DACA, because of the time, that little time that's left before the election in that process. But if we're looking at second Trump administration, I think that, we don't ever know these things, right? I mean, this is all a question of speculation, but right. Put it this way, it would not surprise me at all if we see a rescission. I mean, one of the things that I think was evident in the way the Trump administration tried to go about the rescission was they tried to do it without taking responsibility politically. They basically said, well, you know, we can't do this. We can't have DACA. It kind of tried to shift the responsibility of the court system and by saying, well, we can't keep this because it's illegal. And the court, you know, like Peter said, kept the administration from, in a sense, shifting responsibility, you know, to the courts. And so I think if we're talking about second term, I think the administration would feel empowered to end DACA. The other complication, though, is that DACA has always been part of the politics of immigration. And so we could easily see a lot of negotiation where the administration tries to do something for Dreamers, but the price is you've got to fund the border or a wall or something like that. I mean, this is one of the issues with Dreamers. It's always been issues with regard to this group of young people has always been tied up in larger questions of funding for ICE, of funding for the wall, how we treat asylum. It's all kind of politically so intertwined.
And Peter, one issue that's sort of been in the forefront for me in thinking about this is that in many ways, if DACA is rescinded, it was a bit of a trap for DACA recipients, because part of the deal was that they had to come forward and provide all the information necessary to the government to become a part of that program, making their deportation so much easier. Is there any legal requirement for the courts or for the administration to consider the way in which a DACA recipient could have been a bit, to use a common phrase, that they've been set up to make it easier for them to deport because of their need to report their status to the government?
I'll defer to Hiroshi on the legalities here. I think it's highly unlikely that the Trump administration would, assuming that it would be permissible, that they would systematically go through the DACA rolls and just start rounding DACA beneficiaries up for deportation for exactly the reason that Hiroshi says, that this is, that the Dreamers are a very popular group, and there's actually a pretty broad consensus that some number of them, that their status should be regularized, and it's a matter of politics and the refusal of the Republicans to do this as standalone legislation that has been the main stumbling block. But it would be a very bad look for the Trump administration to go around and to deport otherwise completely innocent, productive, fully integrated members of this class.
Yeah, Hiroshi?
One of the issues that's been brought up in this litigation, in this case, is and there are multiple cases trying to stop the rescission of DACA, but one of the issues that's come up is trying to block the government from using this data or personal information that people submitted in connection with their original DACA applications. And so that issue did not go to the Supreme Court. I mean, what went to the Supreme Court was the question of whether the administration went about the rescission properly and gave a full accounting for what it was doing. Another issue that went to the Supreme Court was whether this was discriminatory. That's an issue that's in the courts but did not go to the Supreme Court is whether or not this information is protected in some way. Now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for the basically the western end of the United States said that there is a claim there, a strong claim that that information is protected. So that's still, you know, being fought over. I agree, though, with Peter politically. It would be, to say the least, attract a lot of negative publicity if the administration started going through and rounding up DACA people. But, you know, there are a couple things going on here. One is that the information that was given is also information that might be used to find parents, sort of really track who's living where. Depends on how much energy and resources they want to put into that. And the other, though, is that I think it does create a great deal of fear in communities, the threat of DACA information being out there. I know that a lot of people now are really, ever since Trump came into office, been concerned about filing paperwork because the information will be out there. And there's been a stronger practice in the Trump administration than ever before to say that if you apply for something and we reject it, we might actually put you in deportation proceedings, even though you might not have been on the radar before. So, I mean, these are all fears that people have, and sometimes it's the threat or the possibility of action that is more significant practically than whether they actually fall through.
And that actually raises an issue that's been, you know, of a concern, and that was the citizenship question on the census. The concern was that if there was a question asking, are you a citizen, it would make non-citizens much less likely to fill out the census form and not be counted. What is the status of that question and the possibilities of, you know, of it being renewed?
I think the census forms have gone out, and right. I don't think they include the question. So right. That bullet has been largely dodged. But Hiroshi's point is very well taken, that immigrants now, legal and undocumented, are very wary of interacting with government authorities of any description. One context in which this is particularly notable is with respect to public benefits to which they are legally entitled, but which they will not seek for fear that somehow it's going to hurt them or relatives with precarious immigration statuses.
Just picking up a little bit on what Peter was saying is that people who are undocumented or people who are not citizens don't live only with other people who are undocumented or other people who are not citizens. I mean, they're most families are so-called mixed families, and or many families are. And so if we're talking about a so-called chilling effect on responding to the census or applying for public benefits or anything like that, it's likely to have an effect on U.S. citizens who live in the same household, many of whom are children, but they may be spouses or other family members.
We've kind of set this up with an important distinction between the administration's approach to illegal or quasi-legal immigration and questions about, you know, legal immigrants, which compels me to the next issue, and that is this question of work visas. A couple of weeks ago, the administration had announced a decision to, you know, to restrict or ban certain types of work visas, and from the political perspective, it seems driven at least in part because of the economic hardships that were caused by the pandemic. First of all, Peter, what exactly was the administration's decision? What types of work visas are they not going to administer, and which ones are they going to continue to?
So there are two major proclamations that President Trump issued under so-called Section 212F. Which gives the president a very broad authority to quote unquote suspend the entry of aliens whose entry would be quote unquote detrimental to the interests of the United States. The April proclamation suspended the issuance of immigrant visas, including employment-based immigrant visas. And then the more recent, the June proclamation suspended the entry of non-citizens who would otherwise be eligible for J visas, which are for jobs like camp counselors, au pairs, certain kinds of teachers, H-1B visas, which are probably in terms of the alphabet soup of non-immigrant visas, they're the most familiar, which apply to so-called specialty occupations. H-2B visas, which apply to so-called seasonal workers. And then L visas, which apply to intra-company transferees, that is, executives who are moved from an office overseas to an office in the United States. So all those visas have been suspended, and they've all been justified in these proclamations in terms of employment, the employment crisis that's been triggered by COVID. So Trump is ostensibly justifying this as that the admitting these visa holders would take jobs away from Americans in a time of urgent need. The empirics for that are pretty close to groundless, but this proclamation very broadly suspend the issuance of an entry of new visa holders.
And Hiroshi, do you agree that these are largely groundless? And what do you think the implications on legal immigration from the Trump administration, what implications should we draw from that based on, on these decisions?
Well, I agree that they're groundless from an economic point of view, in the sense that we're in a situation where, you know, we need the economic engine of the country or the world to be robust. And that involves having the right people doing the work. You know, this is not a one-for-one thing where each person coming in from outside the country takes a job of someone in the country. Most of the time, you have a situation where people come into the country and they create an economic situation within a company that allows for the employment of all kinds of people, including a lot of American citizens. Now, I happen to be on a conference call with someone who is he's a lawyer, but close to and representing some large entities, like, you know, I mean, he actually was talking about representing Fortune 10 as opposed to Fortune 500 companies. And he's saying that the ban on bringing in these so-called L visas, you know, the executives, is really sent a shudder through a lot of the business community, saying, you know, we're trying to open up operations and we're trying to make things, and we don't have the people we were counting on to help us, you know, with the know-how or the management or whatever. So, you know, so in terms of what it means, Doug, I think that a lot of this is about, for a certain, you know, part of the Trump base here, or maybe the whole Trump base, I don't know, it's an argument that's going to win some votes to say we're putting the American worker first in the short term, even though it may hurt them in the medium term and long term, or even, you know, 4 months from now. Same kind of thing we've seen on trade, right? That let's impose tariffs, and you know, that would be the argument from the administration. Let's impose tariffs, which ultimately would raise prices inside the United States and lead to retaliation by other countries for our own exports from the United States. And let's do that because that's going to make a few people happy. And that's kind of the trade-off. So we're seeing the same kind of thing in the Trump administration's responses on legal immigration. And this is on the business side. I mean, there's all kinds of people who are being cut out or kept out on the family immigration front as well. But I think we're really seeing kind of an isolationism economically that's manifested in these visa restrictions.
And it's also, it's basically advancing the restrictionist agenda under cover of COVID. It's clear that the restrictionists within the administration are opportunistically advancing the restrictionist agenda, using the, you know, the real concerns posed by COVID as a justification. And those justifications will stand up in court, I think. So they're learning from their defeats in the Supreme Court in cases like the DACA case, and are doing their process with an understanding that that's what they have to do to make things stick. And I think, although this use of 212F authority is clearly unprecedented, that it's very unlikely that the Supreme Court would strike down these actions.
It reminds me of a famous politician who once said, never let a good crisis go to waste. And certainly the administration's had a lot of things on its to-do list. And the administration has, quite opportunistically, as Peter says, used this chance, used the pandemic to do a lot of things that were, I think, quite clearly on the agenda to start with.
And you could say that, I mean, one message coming out of the Roberts decisions in DACA and the census cases is just lie better next time. You know, just make sure that you've got some rational justification for the action, and that will do the trick.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Beckett. We're discussing the legal and political issues of immigration with the Trump administration, broadly with the United States. Now, kind of shifting gears a little bit, one of the areas on immigration that has certainly been politically volatile and has dominated headlines has been the status of asylum seekers, in particular on the southern border of the United States. And I know that there have been some decisions, again, citing COVID as a justification of these and some of these asylum applications, or at least kind of slow them down. So I'll start with you, Peter. First of all, what is the actual policy of the administration, and what are some of the legal issues that are raised with the way it's been confronting asylum seekers since it took office in 2017?
I mean, the inclination of this administration is not to validate any asylum claims and not to let any of them in and not to extend any process to many of them. The Supreme Court, in a decision that got a lot less attention than the DACA case, just upheld so-called expedited removal of certain asylum seekers in a very broad decision, which in effect denies that aliens outside the United States, or in the petitioner's case, 25 feet within the United States, just have no due process rights protected under the Constitution, and that they get only what Congress gives them. Asylum is its own whole world. And I mean, again, I'm going to defer to Hiroshi. One gets the sense that with respect to undocumented immigration, legal immigration, asylum and refugee policy, that there's just so much coming at us that it's, I think for even for the advocates, it's hard to keep up with what's going on and respond to this activity. But so I'll defer to Hiroshi on the particulars of what's going on the southern border, other than basically it's shut.
Yeah, Hiroshi.
It is an attempt by the administration to shut off asylum. I mean, well, you know, one thing that's just taking a step back. I mean, the United States is a party to an international treaty that recognizes asylum protections, refugee convention. And so Congress has set up a process for deciding asylum claims. And so the administration has done a number of things, a lot of things actually, that have in various ways tried to make it harder to apply for asylum. And I'm sure if I list even a few of them, it'll be incomplete, but just to give you a flavor for this. I mean, first of all, there was an attempt that wasn't successful, but to make people apply for asylum only at ports of entry. Then there's attempt still going on now that people can apply, but then they have to wait in Mexico while their cases are going to be heard. The administration's trying to first say that anyone coming from, the most recent version would say that you'll get shunted off to Guatemala if you are applying for asylum. And then the administration also, through some administrative law rulings actually issued directly by the attorney general, or different attorney generals, but different cases at different times, you know, raise the standards for getting asylum. And, you know, I think that what we're seeing really here is a couple of different things. One is the administration trying to do what it can do without going to Congress, because I think Congress would not adopt these changes. And the second thing is really trying to turn its back on the system for protecting refugees, the system that, you know, emerged after World War II. And so it's been around for several generations. And I think there's a great deal of sentiment in the administration that the United States really shouldn't be part of that, part of the system, at least as it's played out over the last 70 years or so, 70 or 80 years.
So with respect to some of the issues with asylum seekers, there's the additional concern from human rights advocates that the ways in which asylum seekers have been collected, the ways in which they've been housed, you know, et cetera, could violate certain international human rights provisions, human rights norms. Now, I know the U.S. doesn't have a terribly good track record in ratifying human rights treaties, human rights conventions, but is this a fair criticism that not just the question of whether or not the U.S. will process these asylum applications, but the treatment of asylum seekers while they await this processing is in contravention to human rights norms? Ask Peter first.
I'm going to pass the ball to Hiroshi on this.
Go ahead. Hiroshi.
Asylum is a right, or it's a thing, certainly, of protection, and it's been recognized in international convention, Geneva Convention, for protection of refugees, and that's been incorporated into U.S. domestic law as well. And so what I think you're referring to is not just the attempts by the administration to restrict access to the asylum system, but things like the conditions under which asylum seekers are being held. There's a lot of restrictions on, practical restrictions on the ability to claim asylum. And this could be a simple thing as whether someone is in detention while their case is going on. And so it's all part of the general skepticism of asylum claims. I mean, they're small things. I mean, it's one thing I think just to keep in mind in general with this administration is that you have the things that get a lot of publicity, like executive actions, proclamations, things like that. But there's a lot of things that are kind of under the radar that are practically very important. Things like putting money into ICE agents, but not necessarily into deciding cases and things like that. So, you know, an example of this that relates to your question about asylum is trying to make sure that asylum seekers are kept in detention, you know, essentially for as long as possible during the period in which they're pursuing their claims, which makes it really hard for them to get legal help. And it makes it more likely that when they explain why they fear for their lives, going back to wherever they're from, when they make those statements that they're not going to have the help of a lawyer, for example, who understands exactly what the legal requirements are, that might lead to someone not saying something that's absolutely crucial and would be the basis for protection. And so, these are issues that are serious human rights issues, but I also think that it's important to remember that these are issues protected by U.S. law as well. There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah, one point that Hiroshi makes, which can't be overemphasized, is how this administration has exploited the discretion, the broad discretion that's available in implementing immigration laws in a way that just, I mean, I said earlier that lawyer advocates are having trouble keeping up with all this stuff. Journalists are spread very thinly on this. And so there's a lot of very important activity that's happening, just not getting reported, or it's getting reported, especially in the avalanche of other news, reported in a way that just gets lost in the mix. I mean, one story just from the last couple of days is that a large number, I think a majority of employees of USCIS, that is the visa, the benefits granting arm of the Department of Homeland Security, have been put on furlough, because the fees from visa-related actions no longer cover the budget of the agency. And so they're now getting furloughed, and which just means that fewer of these benefits are being processed. And that's the kind of story that it's just not going to be above the fold these days, and just not going to be able to generate the kind of outrage that it really should.
I absolutely agree with you. There's been such a flood of issues in dealing with immigration questions that it's so difficult to try to keep up with all the issues that have raised. And it seems to be one of the strategies of the administration is to flood the news with so many stories. It's difficult to remember some of these stories. So one that certainly comes to mind are the travel bans that Hiroshi had referenced earlier in the show. Was Muslim majority countries and then a handful of other countries that were added in subsequent travel ban cases because the court had actually called them out. It called the administration specifically out and overturned decisions because they were all majority Muslim countries. First of all, what's the status of these travel bans? And is there any legal redress remaining to try to address these concerns? Or is it at this point really in the hands of the electorate? Hiroshi.
Yes, the travel bans are in effect. The Supreme Court upheld them under a very deferential standard. That in some ways the administration lucked out. Remember, I mean, it seems like ancient history now, that was travel ban 3.0. Remember, they had the first travel ban that was issued during the first week of the administration, which resulted in chaos at the airports and was, I tell my students that any of them after a couple of weeks of immigration law could have done a better job drafting that proclamation than the Trump administration did. But as a result of the chaos, they had to go back and revise that not once, but twice. And the third time around, they got it. They lied better. And the Roberts Court validated the proclamation in a way that I think makes it pretty difficult to challenge any of these subsequent proclamations, which have been issued under the same authority. So the more recent suspensions of entry with respect to certain non-immigrant worker visas and immigrant visas were issued under the same authority. And the Supreme Court in the travel ban case approved that ban under a standard, which I think will make it difficult, if not impossible, to win in the courts against the more recent actions.
Yeah, Hiroshi?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that that the Supreme Court in the, I guess, the Muslim ban, travel ban, a lot of terminological argument too, but in upholding it, makes it very hard to challenge the ban. The more recent ban involves a lot of African countries. I think numerically the most significant country we're talking about is Nigeria. The Supreme Court did leave some opening. Well, let me take a step back. The Supreme Court relied on the fact that you could get waivers. In other words, you can get exceptions. You can come in spite of the ban by way of exception. And the Supreme Court relied to some extent on the availability of the exception. Now, if it turns out the exception turns out to be bogus in some way, in the sense that it's really nearly impossible to get, it takes forever to get, there's some opening the Supreme Court left for the ban still to be struck down as the case goes through the courts for a more detailed investigation. But I agree with Peter that the Supreme Court set it up in such a way that it's going to be really hard to go through on those commitments, because in the immigration area, you know, once you say the words national security, it's hard to win against the United States government here. So, you know, that's what we're seeing. And so we're seeing a confluence of security-based reasons with the COVID issues in the zone where the administration can do quite a bit. And Congress over the years has passed statutes that give a lot of latitude to the president. This president has certainly used those powers much more aggressively and much more broadly than prior administrations.
Now, I know there's been some international consequences to some of these decisions. The one that recently was announced was the European Union's decision to not allow for American travel to the EU. What was cited in the press was concerns that the U.S. didn't really have the COVID pandemic under control. But what was always included in more meaningful and nuanced discussions is the fact that this was somewhat retaliatory on the part of the EU, that the U.S. has restricted some EU travel, and then a number of Europeans see this as a way to retaliate against the U.S. Can we expect to see more of this type of retaliation, to where, in essence, though the U.S. is restricting travel, immigration, work permits, green cards from countries abroad, that's going to be harder for Americans as well to travel abroad? Has retaliation been one of the hallmarks of these policies?
I wouldn't characterize the EU's action as retaliatory. It was undertaken on very objective criteria relating to incidents, COVID incidents. And in fact, if anything, the EU is probably pretty wary about, was pretty wary about blocking the U.S. because it knows that this administration will take it as having been retaliatory in some way, sort of take it personally in a way that might have unintended consequences. But I mean, the world is sort of on lockdown, or it's just coming out of lockdown. I mean, places that have been most successful in controlling the virus, like New Zealand, just said nobody's coming in. So that complicates the whole picture and thinking about Trump administration immigration policies. I think it's really only after the lockdown significantly eases on a global basis that we'll be able to assess, for instance, how pretextual some of the administration's justifications have been. But I mean, the main message coming out of the EU ban on US travelers is just, we're doing a terrible job with COVID. And it makes total sense for the EU to limit entry of individuals who have been in the US because, you know, they're trying to keep a lid. I mean, they seem to be keeping a lid on it. And obviously letting people in from Arizona and Texas and other hotspots isn't going to help them on that front.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Peter is saying. And because I wouldn't, I mean, retaliation's a, you know, hard label to kind of justify in any kind of scientific way, because you have to dig into the minds of the people who make these decisions. But and I don't claim to be an expert on public health in the European Union, I have followed enough to get a sense that their decisions have been driven, let's say, more by the public health authorities than those decisions might have been driven in the United States, certainly at the national level. And so, I don't know, maybe it makes a difference that Angela Merkel is a professional scientist, maybe it has to do with the public health structures in some countries versus others. But that's the reason. I mean, retaliation is a term that is, you know, certainly one of political culture and not necessarily one of public health culture. And I have, my sense is that the European Union's reaction is driven by some legitimate public health considerations that are justified by some of the data that we're seeing.
I mean, it is interesting that we're getting some of our own medicine here. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's not the right metaphor to use in this context, but U.S., I mean, Americans are used to being able to travel without basically any formalities almost anywhere in the world. And now that we're subject to travel restrictions, I think it sort of brings home, maybe not our immigration policies, but just how bad a job we're doing with the pandemic.
Throughout the hour, we've painted this picture of immigration policy where there have been some examples of legal restrictions, but those examples really don't predominate immigration policy. I think one of the lessons we take from this is that the executive is given quite a bit of latitude on immigration policy, and that in particular when citing national security concerns, that courts have been generally pretty reluctant to step in, except frequently on process issues as opposed to on necessarily substance issues. How much of the legal response to the Trump administration and the Trump administration itself been an anomaly on American immigration policy, and how much of it is fairly consistent with previous administrations, albeit likely taking it further, but the trend, you know, has been in place for the executive, you know, to cite national security in ways to try to restrict immigration. Peter.
Hiroshi, you want to go? Hiroshi's one of the leading historians.
Oh, absolutely. And Hiroshi, I'll ask you.
I thought Peter was one of the leading historians. I mean, there's a lot to say about this. And so I'll just kick this off a little bit. I mean, certainly national security has a... you know, cuts a pretty broad swath in these conversations, right? So that's clearly the case. And every administration has cited national security for all kinds of decisions it's made after 9/11. I mean, at various other times in history, sometimes there are episodes that with a generation or two hindsight, the country regrets. But at any rate, that's happened. But I think, and so in that sense, the administration is, in some sense, taking advantage of a longstanding tradition to defer to the administration, both in the moment, but also by the structure of what the power of the administration or the executive branch has been given. You know, that said, I think the Trump administration will be seen, you know, if we're talking about this, the 30, 50 years from now, as an administration that really moved away from kind of a consensus, you know, not a universal sort of a view, certainly, but sort of a view that even if there's going to be back and forth on how hard to be on illegal immigration, that there's something about America's nation of immigrants, and that legal immigration is generally a good thing for the economy and for the culture. And I think the Trump administration represents a skepticism of that view of immigration, the nation of immigrants view. I mean, it's no accident that the nation of immigrants was removed from the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services website as sort of its self-identity, I suppose, if you want to put it in those terms. So in that sense, I think the administration is taking advantage or using, or maybe I shouldn't put it so pejoratively, as just using mechanisms like citing national security that all administrations have used to one degree or another. But I think that this administration has been much more aggressive about that and much more broad about the way it's done that. In that sense, this administration, I think, is an outlier looking back from the period from this administration on back through really quite a bit of history, maybe before World War II.
Yeah, I completely agree that what sets this administration apart is a change in the culture that prior administrations, Republican and Democrat, have generally adopted the rhetoric of the United States as a country of immigrants, that is as a positive feature of our traditions. Ronald Reagan was hugely pro-immigrant, and including with respect to undocumented immigrants, the last major regularization having been adopted during his administration. So the change in the culture, combined with the fact that even through these prior administrations, which have been more or less pro-immigrant, that there's their court doctrines and norms, which enable a tremendous amount of executive branch autonomy in the exercise of this authority. And since you can think of the precedents relating to immigration as sort of laying around like a loaded gun. That prior administrations, they didn't use the machine gun. They may have taken pot shots, which they understood they could get away with because of the deference that's afforded to presidents in this context. But the Trump administration is really just an assault rifle. And because the doctrine is there, the precedent, the so-called plenary power of the political branches is well established in the jurisprudence, they've basically gotten away with it. And so one thing that'll be interesting looking forward is assuming and hoping that we have a Biden administration. It's clear that there'll be a very long punch list of administrative actions that will be reversed. Then that will be a top administration of a Biden, a top priority of a Biden administration. The question is, well, will there be some action to limit the exercise of this authority going forward, so that the weapon, at least there's some kind of safety put on the gun, so that it's not available to future Trumps to wreak the kind of havoc that he's wreaked during his administration with respect to immigration.
Well, just a brief add-on to that is it's interesting to look at several of the opinions in the decision that by a narrow majority upheld the travel ban or the Muslim ban, whatever term you want to use. And there are a couple of justices that essentially were clearly writing not for this administration, but for presidents in general. And they pretty much said that we have a system that defers the president. If we knew that every president was like this, we wouldn't have that system. But we're counting on not every president to be like this. And so we're going to just get through this period, and we're not going to diminish the power of the president in general. And in fact, you have at least one justice of the Supreme Court in that time saying essentially that they don't like what the president is doing, but they're going to just bear with it. Because they're trying to look ahead to the general run of American history and American presidencies. Now, you know, time will tell if that was too sanguine and too optimistic a view of the presidency and how the Supreme Court should act in a given moment, in a given case. But it was clear that there's the sense of this president and presidents in general.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the court has ruled on this is to treat this presidency as a normal presidency from a separation of powers perspective. And I think you both have highlighted a very important question, sort of two related questions. The first, you know, has the court erred in that presumption? And the second being that it's clear that this is a political question, at least as much, if not more so, than the legal question. And so at the pains of finishing with something cliched, elections clearly matter. And the resonance of each of these offices matter a great deal. So thank you very much for your insights today. We have spoken about the DACA case and U.S. immigration policy, the role the courts have played, and our guests have been Peter Spiro, Charles R. Wiener Professor of Law at Temple University. He's the author of Citizenship, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Hiroshi Motomura, Susan Westerberg Prager, Distinguished Professor of Law at UCLA. He is the author of Immigration Outside the Law.
When we come back, incarceration generation, the chances that children have of having a parent imprisoned.
Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
Some call the modern age the incarceration generation. Tough on crime laws and stiff sentencing procedures have contributed to higher and higher incarceration rates in the U.S. Over the past three decades, the rates have multiplied. In fact, for today's children, chances of having a parent in prison is at its peak, especially for poor African-American children. And studies show that their chances of breaking the cycle is increasingly difficult. With a host of emotional struggles and depression, low self-esteem, these children frequently face greater likelihood of homelessness, social isolation, violence, and other obstacles for their futures. Christopher Wilderman joins us now. He is a professor of sociology and a scholar at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He's authored three papers about these risks. Welcome, Christopher Wilderman.
Thanks, Maria.
Great to have you with us. I think I want to start with the statistics. You compared 1978 to 1990 and the chances that children have of having a parent imprisoned.
Yes, I did.
Why don't you give us a brief overview of that?
So the basic idea behind that paper was just that African-American children were not only much more likely to experience the event than white children were, but also that there was a huge increase in those risks. And I think the core finding from that paper is that about 1 in 4 African-American children could expect to have a parent imprisoned at some point by the time they were 14 years old, while for African-American children whose parents didn't finish high school, about 1 in 2 could expect to experience that risk.
And go ahead.
Oh, and the risks were tremendously lower for white children who had about a 1 in 40 chance of experiencing that event.
And I think given what we know about the incarceration rates for African Americans, it's not surprising about the parental factor, the risk of having a parent being imprisoned at some point. But I think the other findings that are really significant that we should be talking about is, of course, the impact that it's having on these kids in the long term for their health, their well-being, their life expectancy, and also the possibility of them not repeating the footsteps of parents. So let's talk about some of these things. There are three things that you ultimately looked at: infant mortality, homelessness, and aggressive behaviors. Also, there's something on dropping out of school as well, I believe. I don't know if that was in your paper.
That wasn't in my paper, but I can provide a quick summary probably.
Well, why don't we start with, why don't you choose which one you want to start with? Infant mortality, homelessness, dropping out, and aggressive behaviors.
I'll start with the physically aggressive behaviors bit because I think that's sort of what criminologists have been fixated on for 30 years or longer. It's just this sort of idea that crime and incarceration are passed down through families. And what the study finds is that there's a substantial increase in the levels of physically aggressive behaviors of boys who have a father go to prison between around age 3 and around age 5. And I think what this calls us to think about is that these were kids who already sort of were exposed to a host of other forms of disadvantage, you know, likely to be poor, likely to have parents who had relatively low levels of educational attainment. And, you know, even in addition to sort of the effects of those risk factors on their physically aggressive behaviors, you see that paternal incarceration also sort of further increases their levels of physical aggression at age 5.
Do you think that it is actually the incarceration factor or that it is the absence of the parent being there?
You know, it's a really good question, and Sarah Wakefield's work really touches on this in an excellent way. But I think my best sense is that it's not just the absence of the parent, but it's also sort of the trauma of a parent sort of cycling in and out of the system. It's not like something like divorce, where your parents divorce and there's this, you know, period where they were together and then they're separated and then you're navigating that. It's more like your father's in for a year and a half, he's back out for 6 months, he's back in, he's back out. It introduces all this instability into kids' lives that something that only happens once doesn't necessarily do.
The other question that it raised for me as I was looking at this is whether or not it impacted if it was a violent crime or if it was a nonviolent crime that the parent was imprisoned for, and if that impacted the aggressive behavior.
It's a tricky issue, and I think people have speculated about that for a long time. Well, there are two interesting things that I find that sort of have to do with this. One is just that if there was domestic violence in the household, it actually looks like paternal incarceration substantially decreases kids' physically aggressive behaviors. And if it was a violent crime, it looks like effects are relatively small, but it's difficult to tell. So it does seem plausible that effects are concentrated among nonviolent offenders both within the household and also outside of it.
And then infant mortality. Talk about that and connect that to incarcerated parents.
I'll probably just talk about homelessness along with that because I think these speak to the same sort of basic issue. So usually when academics and folks like that talk about effects of parental incarceration on kids, the fact that these kids are already really disadvantaged is an obstacle to figuring out whether it was incarceration or, as you mentioned earlier, you know, crime or other hosts of disadvantage that are causing these poor outcomes for kids. And I guess the reason that something like infant mortality or homelessness are interesting are because these are events that we think of very few kids as experiencing at some point, and indeed relatively few kids do. But for families that we think of as maybe sort of hanging on by a thread, we might expect the experience of parental incarceration to compromise that child's care arrangements in a way that could increase risk of infant mortality, or to mean that they no longer have a place to live, that their sort of household is in upheaval as a result of this event. And what you find in the two papers is that having a parent incarcerated does about double the risk of experiencing homelessness for at least one day in the last year, you know, sleeping somewhere that you wouldn't usually sleep, like a car. And that it also increases the risk of infant mortality for kids by about 35%.
Those are pretty high numbers, very high numbers. One of the other things that you have said, both in your papers and I believe you were quoted in the New York Times about this, is you called this a distinctively American phenomenon.
Mm-hmm, I did. What I mean to say by that is just that no longstanding Western European democracy incarcerates people at nearly the rate that that we do here. And so what that means is that just like something like homelessness or infant mortality, incarceration is an incredibly uncommon event in a child's life that's restricted to only the most disadvantaged and likely only the most criminally active. Whereas here in America, you can have, 25% of African-American kids experiencing that event. So even though it's not distinctively American in the sense of we're the only people who do it, we're the only people who do it on such a large scale that it could have really important implications for intergenerational inequality and sort of stratification.
And finally, before we let you go, one of the things I thought was really an important factor that you wrote about is that when people, policymakers, are considering the cost and the benefit and doing those kinds of analyses, they're not looking at these other costs to society, including, children's lives who are dying in infancy and all of the future problems that are occurring. So why don't you say a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think this fits into a sort of broader research area that focuses on the effects of incarceration on inequality more broadly. And so you see sort of effects of incarceration on health. A really interesting paper came out that looks at the effects of incarceration on HIV/AIDS infection rates and finds really substantial effects. And I think the hesitancy to think about a lot of these factors stems in large part to the fact that people think that these people who end up in prison are bad parents, are bad citizens, and that having them removed from society ought to be a benefit in terms of removing sort of someone who's criminally active from society, but also someone who's not contributing in any sort of tangible way. And I think it's a real oversight, although it is very difficult to try to quantify a lot of these things. That's a lot of what policy comes down to.
Well, Christopher Wildermann, it's really a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us here.
Thanks for having me.
Christopher Wildermann is a professor and a scholar at the University of Michigan.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.